Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s. Tonight, we are pleased to host author and publisher David Borgenicht. David is known for providing comic relief and true-to-life solutions for dangerous situations in his wildly popular worst-case scenarios survival handbooks. And from how to deal with the nightmare boss or how to take a punch in the gut to how to leap from a motorcycle into a moving car, he offers extreme answers to real-world situations and real-world answers to extreme situations. After high school, David attended the University of Pennsylvania, and like many college students, he would be asked by his family from time to time what he intended to do with his life. His answer was that he didn't want a real job, and all he wanted was for, and I quote, "someone to pay me for all of my stupid ideas," close quote. Well, it appears in some way he may have gotten his wish. And now it is my pleasure to introduce the independent publisher of Quirk Books as he joins us for his first San Francisco appearance ever. Please welcome David Borgenicht.
Thank you very much. It is true, I did want somebody to pay me for my stupid ideas, and many of those people are here tonight. So hopefully at the book signing, that will be all of you. No. Thank you very much. It's truly an honor to be speaking here in front of all of you and at the Commonwealth Club. As I think about the history of this place and all the people who've come before me, to speak in front of you, not necessarily the Inforum, but the club in general, presidents and world leaders, literary figures, hundreds of other great men and women throughout history, people like Teddy Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, Bill Clinton. I have to think there's seriously something wrong with you people. I mean, you really couldn't do any better than me tonight. This place has really gone downhill. It's sad. I mean, I've had a dream, but it's not the kind I can discuss in mixed company, and certainly not on the radio. But actually, now that I think about it, back in 1998, when I first came up with the idea for the worst case scenario survival handbook, I did have a dream. And it was a small dream, but it was a dream nevertheless, and that dream was this: to write a book that would save people's lives. The lives I was most interested in saving were the lives of my wife and myself, because we had to eat. But ultimately, worst case, my dream was really to write a concise but accessible volume that would entertain and amuse and inform, but would save people's lives while simultaneously feeding my family. So I'm gratified to be here, and though I'm not a world leader or historical figure yet, what you hear from me tonight will save your life. It's pretty scary out there these days. You just never do know what's lurking around the corner or swimming underneath the surface. I mean, think about what humans are facing in the world today. It's frightening. There's terrorism and war. There's global warming. There's genocide. There's famine and flood. There's the dating scene. It's frightening. It's more frightening than anything we've ever faced. And you never know when you will be called upon to perform an extreme act of bravery and choose life or death with your own actions. But when you are called, I want you all to know what to do. I want you to know what you need to do when you step into that pool of quicksand. I want you to know what to do when that shark fin starts heading towards you. I want you to know how to escape from that bad date by disguising yourself in the bathroom and slipping out unnoticed through the front door. That, plain and simple, is my mission tonight. And it's always been my mission in writing these worst-case scenario survival handbooks. So tonight, among other things, I intend to teach you the essential skills you'll need to survive when, but not if, life takes that sudden turn for the worst. Now, before I get into that, however, I have been instructed by my attorneys to read the following disclaimer. When a life is imperiled or a dire situation is at hand, safe alternatives may not always exist. To deal with a worst-case scenario, the best course of action is to consult a professionally trained expert. The next best choice, of course, is an author who himself has consulted professionally trained experts. And that's where I come in. Now, because such professionals may not always be available, we have asked them to employ their answers to provide you with the information that you're going to hear tonight. However, I hereby disclaim any liability from any injury that may result from the use, proper or improper, from the information contained in this presentation. And finally, nothing I say may be construed or interpreted to infringe on the rights of other persons or to violate criminal statutes. I urge you all to obey laws and respect all rights, including property rights of others. Now, if you will all acknowledge by saying aye, I can proceed. Okay, that's enough. Thank you. My co-author, Josh Piven, and I were not survival experts when we undertook the writing of the first book. We were just regular, everyday folks like you. My co-author, Josh, grew up in the East. He was a street-smart city boy who attended a gritty but expensive private school. I grew up in the West and spent my youth hiking and camping and fishing, mostly using Velveeta cheese as bait. That's true, actually. So no, we were not survival experts. We were just a couple of inquisitive authors who worried a lot. And we're interested in knowing how to survive a variety of crisis situations. And together, over the past 8 years, we have consulted experts in a variety of fields to compile the information you're about to hear. Stuntmen, physicians, EMT instructors, bomb squad officers, bullfighters, scuba instructors, sex therapists, FBI agents, and many others. Now, there's an old joke that you may have heard before, but I'm going to tell it anyway. There are two campers. We'll call them Teddy and Franklin, just to continue with the tradition of the Commonwealth Club. And they'd been hiking all day with heavy packs across the wide-open tundra. Now, it was towards the end of the day, and they see this dangerous, large brown bear standing up on its hind feet about 300 meters away. Now, knowing the way of bears and being pretty experienced hikers, they both froze, not daring to move for fear of giving away their position. But they both saw that in the direction of the wind, the bear could smell them, and they realized their scent was headed directly towards it. So they started seeing the bear's nose tweak and saw him notice their presence. Now, Teddy, became worried, and even more so when the bear launched off in all fours right in their direction. And as he reached for his rifle, he saw Frank sit calmly down on the tundra, take off his pack, open it, and bring out a pair of new running shoes. As the bear rapidly approached, Frank calmly put the shoes on. "What are you doing?" Ted yelled. "Don't you know you can't run a bear on attack? They run at least 35 miles per hour." Frank looked up and finished lacing his shoes and said, "Yeah, I know, but I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you." It's an old one, but a good one. The joke does bring me to the key principles for surviving any worst-case scenario. And this can apply to any situation, extreme or real world. Be prepared, don't panic, and have a plan. Survival experts agree that these three principles will help you emerge intact from pretty much anything you get yourself into. Now, Ted was not prepared. Frank was. He didn't panic. He had the plan, and he made it out alive. These are the basics for surviving whatever life throws your way. Over the course of writing 13 different worst-case scenario books, however, I have come to think that there's one additional skill that you do need, and that is this: maintain your sense of humor. Our books have really helped people apply all these principles, but in all honesty, the impetus for the first book really came more from that final skill, the humor one. Back in 1998, when I had the idea to write the first worst-case scenario survival handbook, I had left this low but consistently paying job at a local book publisher in Philadelphia and was trying to make ends meet by writing and editing and designing and, in general, producing books for book publishers. I had always wondered, however, even as a kid, what I would do if I found myself in a truly disastrous situation, in the kinds of situations that I'd seen for years in action movies, the things that James Bond and MacGyver and Indiana Jones seem to get into. Dozens of Bruce Willis characters have encountered these things. And that was sort of my mentality at the time. Plus, it was 1998, and survival was in the air. Everyone was talking about Y2K and books like Into Thin Air and The Perfect Storm were on the bestsellers list. So survival was certainly in the air, and all the stories in the media were about man versus nature. I was reading an article, I think it was in Esquire, about a man who had to land a plane without the help of the pilot. The pilot had some of a, sort of a heart attack, and something just clicked. The article recounted step by step what that hapless passenger, who had had no previous flight training, had to do to bring a small prop plane safely down to Earth. And I realized there are indeed real solutions to these highly unlikely situations. I started to make a list of all kinds of different situations and to think about what kinds of people would have the answers. I interviewed a few experts and wrote up a sample and took the book to the Frankfurt Book Fair. Sold the book to a fabulous local publisher, Chronicle Books, whose representatives are nowhere in the audience and don't need to be flattered. But they are amazing. Check them out at chroniclebooks.com. Then the hard part came. We actually had to write it. It was tough at first because most of the people that we contacted, engineers and stuntmen and FBI agents and the like, thought that we were just joking. How could we actually want instructions for defusing a bomb or the correct way to jump out of a moving car? Plus, they were afraid of the liability, despite that I assured them that we'd have a big disclaimer. But eventually, we did find experts who were willing to talk to us and give us specific, clear, step-by-step instructions. The book, first book, came out a year later, and it was a slow but immediate hit. And I think the beauty was that it did work on two levels. It worked as a humor book. It was actually and continues to be sold in the humor section. And it also worked as a basic survival manual. I think to date it's probably the only book that's been called essential reading by both The New Yorker and Soldier of Fortune. Although I'm pretty sure that The New Yorker was being ironic. But you get a sense of this if you read the reviews for it on Amazon. It really has broad appeal. Some love it because it does give them real answers to those situations that they've always wondered about. Others think it's the greatest bathroom book ever written. And I think the truth is that it's probably both. So the book was a hit, and we did what all red-blooded Americans with a hit on their hands would do. We started working on sequels and merchandising. To date, we've come out with 13 different worst-case scenario editions with more to come. We've looked at travel and dating and sex. We've done golf and work, holidays and parenting, college and weddings, life, extreme, and even an almanac and a guide to surviving history's worst case scenarios. All of them offer that same mix of practical and impractical knowledge, real solutions to extreme situations and extreme solutions to real situations. But across the board, whatever the topic, survival comes back to those same basic points. Be prepared, don't panic, have a plan, and maintain your sense of humor. Laughter is indeed the best medicine, and a positive attitude can certainly help you hang on for those few extra seconds that it might save your life. And it can also make important things more memorable. You remember the funny things more than the unfunny ones, and we've heard from a lot of readers over the years who claim that as a result of having read these humor books, they've actually emerged intact from some pretty dangerous situations. We heard from a guy in Seattle who claimed that as a result of having read our books, he knew what to do in the earthquake back in 2001. We heard from a man here in San Francisco who claimed that because of the first book, he knew how to break down a door when his girlfriend's apartment caught on fire and was able to save her life. And we heard from a woman in Southern California who wrote to us and said that because of worst case, she knew what to do when she encountered a mountain lion while hiking in the hills near L.A. She knew to stand her ground and to pick her kid up and to try to make herself appear larger, not to run, and the cat left her alone. And, you know, while it's possible that the mountain lion really just wanted to direct, it's also entirely likely that our book did help somebody out. So I'm completely serious when I say that what I'm about to tell you may just save your life. Listen carefully, because these may be the most five most important things that you ever hear. So, how to fend off a shark. Sharks. Now, these are predators, and they usually will only follow through on an attack if they have an advantage, a physical advantage, not an ideological one. So they're very unlike the Bush administration in this way. But as you know, in life, you're going to encounter all sorts of sharks, especially in love and business. And the key thing with fending off a shark is this. Making the shark unsure of its advantage will increase your chances of survival. So here's what to do. Let me take a sip first. The first thing you want to do with a shark is to hit back with anything you've got. If you've got a camera, a probe, a harpoon gun would be nice. But certainly your fist or your fingers, anything you've got to hit the shark in the eyes or the gills, the areas of the shark that are most sensitive to pain. You want to make sharp, repeated jabs in these areas. Hitting the shark simply lets it know that you are not defenseless. You're not a defenseless fish. And it's not used to these fish fighting back, so they usually tend to break off their attacks. Now, contrary to popular opinion, the person that we spoke to, George Burgess, who studies shark attacks down in Australia, says that the nose is not the area to attack. And the reason is this. It is just as sensitive as the eyes or the gills, but if you miss the nose, you end up in the mouth. Yeah. A few other shark attack tips it might be handy to know. Do not wear shiny jewelry in the water. The reflected light off jewelry resembles the sheen of fish scales and may attract the shark's attention. Avoid waters with known effluents or sewage. I think that's a good policy in general. But these are used by sports and commercial fishermen, which means they usually have good feeding grounds for sharks. Look for diving seagulls and other seabirds to indicate this. And finally, and I think this is where sometimes survival just is about common sense, do not, I repeat, do not enter the water if you're bleeding from an open wound. Now, the principles of shark attacks can be applied to a lot of other situations. I think it's clear that if you have to fight back, you want to think about where the most sensitive areas are and kick them where it counts. Don't attract attention. Don't go into the water when you're bleeding. These are just good life rules that seem intuitive in life sometimes, but also work against sharks. Sometimes, however, survival is about doing the counterintuitive, like when it comes to surviving quicksand. Now, the first speaker here was Teddy Roosevelt, not at the Inforum again, but he was most famous, obviously, for inspiring the teddy bear and for saying, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." And a big stick is exactly what you need when you're traveling in quicksand country. Now, quicksand is not the exotic thing that you see in the movies. It's actually just ordinary sand mixed with upwelling water, and that makes it behave like a liquid. However, unlike water, quicksand does not easily let go. If you try to pull your limb out of quicksand too quickly, you have to work against the vacuum that you're leaving behind. Now, the good news is that you don't just need a monkey, like in the Tarzan films, to help you out. Floating on quicksand is actually relatively easy because you're more buoyant. And the problem is when you try to struggle too hard against it. Now, the folks that we spoke to about this scenario recommend that when you're walking in quicksand country, you should carry a big stick and or some sort of a stout pole at very least. This will help you not just identify the sand in the first place, but establish equilibrium should you find yourself in it. What you want to do as soon as you start to sink is to lay the pole on the surface of the sand. Then flop your back onto the top of the pole. This helps achieve that equilibrium. After a minute or two, you'll stop sinking. Then you want to work the pole to a new position at right angles to your hips. So it's sort of extending like this. And slowly pull out one leg and then the other. And finally, take the shortest route to firm ground, moving slowly. The main principle behind surviving quicksand can also come in handy, even if you never find yourself in such a situation. The more you struggle, the more you get sucked in. It's like getting in an argument with your mother or a Scientologist. But to paraphrase Mr. Roosevelt, if you move slowly and carry a big stick, you should make it out alive. Quicksand is not what it seems when it comes to survival, and that is a common problem. Often, survival is about knowing what you're getting yourself into. That's the be prepared line. But it is one thing to survive the forces of nature, to survive animal attacks or even human-caused disasters. After all, a fire is always going to act like a fire, and a shark's always going to act like a shark. But more human situations, like dating and work, are a bit more unpredictable. Human nature, after all, is more unpredictable than Mother Nature. And I think dating is the least predictable of them all. And that's when keeping your sense of humor becomes key. When it comes to dating, the most important question you're going to ask is this: how will I know if he's an axe murderer? Well, don't panic. You can use your powers of observation and intuition and watch for the following clues. Is he a Caucasian male? Is he obsessed with fire and matches? Is he cruel to animals? Does he have a history of bedwetting? Was he abused as a child? Is he a middle-class loner? Does he have difficulty maintaining relationships? If your date has three of these traits, that's when you should start to get worried. Trust your intuition about this. Use the Federal Prison Locator Service at bop.gov or Google him and see if you can find out more about his background. If you do discover some grounds for suspicion here, you want to break it off immediately. Be clear and definite. Return any gifts that he's given you. try not to make him angry, and take whatever steps necessary to maintain your safety. Now, if you're a man, the axe murderer thing isn't quite as important. After all, most axe murderers are usually men. So for men, the most important question is this. How will I know if she's a she? And again, you want to use your powers of observation. Look at her hand. If you compare the length of your date's fourth and second fingers, you'll get a good sense of this. Now, most men, and you can all check this out in the audience, have a ring finger that is noticeably longer than your index finger as you put your hand out like that. Most women have ring fingers that are close to the same length. So don't feel bad if you're not meeting these criteria. You also want to look for excess hair on the hands or the wrists. This can also be a good indication. Be very suspicious of baggy clothing. Look for an Adam's apple. Observe the shoulders and their hips. Men's shoulders tend to be broader than their hips, and women's are closer to the same size. Notice how she walks. Men tend to walk in more of a straight-ahead motion, while women tend to sway. Now, voice, however, is not a good indicator. It could just be hard living. But again, being prepared, having this knowledge, and checking things out beforehand can come in handy. Now, should worst come to worst, and should you feel that you need to escape from that bad date, there are some simple answers to that worst-case scenario as well. We got these tips from a former FBI agent and a master of disguise. If you need to get yourself out of the dating situation, the first thing you want to try to do is fake some sort of an emergency. Excuse yourself from the table, take your cell phone, call a friend or a relative, and have them call you back in 5 minutes. Then make up some sort of a personal or professional or health crisis. Tell your date, my boss is in Seattle and I have to go to work and email that presentation, or my brother needs a kidney. Anything that you can come up with will suffice, because what you need to do now is just leave quickly. Don't let him object. Don't take no for an answer. Just make for the door. Now, if you can't pull this one off or you can't reach anyone on your cell phone, your next best course of action is to try to slip away unnoticed. Excuse yourself. Take your handbag or briefcase with you. And take note of any alternate exits as you make your way to the restroom. Then do something while you're in the restroom to alter your appearance. Add or remove articles of clothing. If you've got a scarf or a sweater, take it off or put it on. If you're wearing glasses, take them off or put them on. Anything you can to make yourself look a little different. Change your hair. If it's pulled back, let it down. If it's down, pull it back. Slick it back. Do anything you can. Add a limp or some sort of a strange gait to your walk. Something that makes yourself a little different than you were before. And then, of course, sneak out the back if you can, or just move quickly out the front. I'm not sure if she spoke here, but I think it was Pat Benatar who said love is a battlefield. And I do hope that will help you win that war. Finally, the workplace. Most people spend at least a third of their adult waking lives on their job. Now, this means you'll spend more time sitting in your desk chair than you will shopping or driving your car, playing with your dog, running errands, going to the gym, and playing with your children combined. I've been signaled, by the way, that if you have any questions for me, the Q&A portion will begin shortly. So think about your questions and feel free to start lining up at the microphone there. So in any event, when it comes to the workplace, the odds are staggering that something's going to go wrong while you're there. It's where you spend most of your time. But there's no sense in making it worse by being unprepared and succumbing to the physical and mental and occupational disasters. So, the worst of these, of course, is the nightmare boss. Now, there are four primary types of nightmare bosses. The first one is the control freak. I think we've all encountered him. Now, the best course of action with the control freak is to bombard him with information. Copy him on every email, even remotely relating to him. Leave towering stacks of reports on his desk. Include him in the most mundane meetings and discussions. You may actually be able to short-circuit his control mechanism with the sheer volume of data that you'll be throwing at him. Next, you want to try to solicit his opinion in a controlled way. If you must leave a decision up to your boss, offer the solution you favor and two or three really lame options. Also, using phrases like, "You've probably already thought of this," and "I tried to put myself in your shoes when I came up with this," will help you gain some favor. By all means, remain calm and pleasant, and whenever your boss does interfere or second-guess you, simply say, "Oh, how ridiculous, I should have thought of that. Thank goodness I included you." And just then continue to do your work and bide your time. The next nightmare boss you might encounter is the buddy. Now, the buddy is the boss who attempts to blur the lines between the employee and supervisor, soliciting personal information and seeking inclusion as if you're the best of friends. The key here is to include your buddy, the buddy, in small ways and yet keep your distance. So you do this by inventing a hobby. Avoid sharing actual personal details of your life by inventing a hobby that you can discuss in minute detail. Your fictional toothpick sculptures or houses of cards can become of great interest to you and your boss and serve as the basis for your friendship. Other safe topics to resort to are movies and sports and restaurants. With the buddy, you do need to think about offering social invitations, but only offer those you know he or she can't accept. Offer lunch when you know she has another appointment, drinks with the gang on nights when she has yoga class or is out of town. Now, the danger here is that she may offer invitations in return, so be prepared with a conflict of your own. And finally, avoid all contact. If she attempts a friendly hug or a touch, fake a sneeze. Blame allergies, but don't blame perfume or cologne because that can be changed. And the nice thing about allergies is that they can then become another topic of interest for you to discuss with your buddy. There's also the workaholic boss. And now this boss has lost all sense of perspective, has completely sacrificed his life to his job, and will expect exactly the same of you. So in this case, you want to present evidence of the real world outside work. Replace calendars with ones depicting tropical scenes or vacation destinations. Purchase office subscriptions to food and travel and entertainment magazines. Email him regularly with news and updates of social events that are not work-related. These things can help give him that perspective that he needs. At every opportunity, discuss your family. Display your pictures of your children on your desk. This may trigger memories of the boss that he actually has one too. If he has ever discussed any sort of personal interest outside work, become obsessed with it and pounce on any non-work related subject in the hopes of rekindling that passion. And finally, the other most common nightmare boss you might encounter is, of course, the teller of bad jokes. The common trait here is that his jokes are always bad. So be prepared. Steel yourself for his punchlines. If you're unable to determine when that is, just watch your boss for the response cues, such as a long pause or an expectant grin. Determine the nature of the required reaction. Now, a secure bad joke teller boss We'll be satisfied with a friendly groan or a reluctant head shake. An insecure one will require a more elaborate response, which you'll need to practice in front of a mirror. You can fake amusement with the shoulder shake, which involves smiling and sort of covering your mouth and you know, just kind of tee-heeing a little bit silently. Now, the amused chuckle is more of a verbal expression that's requires smiling, directly looking at your boss, and sort of saying, you know, like that. Finally, there's the genuine guffaw, which is probably the easiest to do. You just kind of smile broadly and let out a single and slap your thigh. Then quickly change the subject so he can't tell another joke. Now, I hope you found these tips helpful. I do pride myself on being one of the few authors out there who can help you save your life, as well as your sanity and your relationship and your job. And I hope you'll remember these skills. I hope you commit them to memory. If they don't sell transcripts of these speeches, I'm happy to announce that we've arranged for the sale of some of these volumes right outside, with your safety in mind, of course. And you can also find them on our website, which is worstcasescenarios.com. But in the meantime, I do truly hope that you don't need this information. If you do, I can take solace in the fact that you are prepared. You won't panic. You have a plan. So be careful out there and take your running shoes. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to David Borgenick, the founder, the owner, and publisher of Quirk Books, for his remarks on how to save your life tonight. I'm sure that someday some of us in this room may have the opportunity to thank you. While members of the audience are lining up at the microphone on the right to ask David some questions, I would like to give a reminder to our those listening on the radio that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we are talking with the author of the Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbooks and other books as well, David Borgenick. And before we go to the audience for some questions, there was one question that I actually discussed with David prior to coming into the meeting room tonight, and it has to do with his success on the New York Times bestsellers list. I've known David really since he was born and was following his career sort of from afar, and noticed one day that there's a book by David Borgenick and Josh Piven on the New York Times bestsellers list. I said, oh, my God. And I went to my wife and mentioned it to her, and she said, oh, yes, didn't I tell you about that? I knew that. So, David, could you, I think you may have had around five books or so that have had that honor on the best New York Times bestsellers list. Could you tell us sort of what they are and maybe the length of time, if you can remember the longest one and some of the other ones?
Right. Well, I think it is five, although I haven't actually counted other than that. But I know that the first one, the Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook, was on the list, and travel was, dating and sex was, work was, and I think golf was too. So yeah, it is five. I believe the first one was on for the longest amount of time, and I think it was about, I want to say like 12 or 15 weeks. It wasn't consistent. It was sort of fell off and on, and bestseller lists are kind of a mysterious thing. Nobody really knows what formula they use to calculate these things. But I was always very frustrated, actually, because the list that we were on wasn't the nonfiction list. It was the advice and how-to and helpful list, and that's only a five-book list. So it was much more difficult to get in the print version of the list than the than the normal fiction list and or the normal nonfiction list. So I was always very bitter about that. But I mean, it's quite an honor to have created a series that even made it there, you know, for 1 week, let alone as long as we've had books on there. And to be fair, it's been a while since we've been back on there. But it does make me wonder, because I think the odds of having a book that hits the bestseller list are probably a lot smaller than the odds of getting attacked by a shark. So I think I probably will run into a shark sooner or later. Just the way life goes.
Well, it's quite an honor. We may want to get back to that later, but we do have people at the microphone, so would the First Lady please ask her question?
So in a situation where extreme situation, you're in an automobile, and suddenly maybe your car goes off a bridge or whatever, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, how do you get out of the car so you have electric windows and everything else we have these days?
Yeah. Well, you want to, you actually want to try to drive with your windows lowered, first of all, if you are driving near water and you think this is a possibility. But, you know, you're not going to have that kind of foresight. If you can maintain some composure before you hit the water, again, try to lower those windows, because that is obviously what you're going to need to do. But this isn't necessarily the way things are going to go. So as soon as you hit the water, try to remain calm, unclip your seatbelt, and then you're actually going to have to either try to break the window or wait until the car fills up with water, because the problem is going to be that you won't be able to open the door due to the water pressure coming in from the outside. And only when the pressure is equalized both inside and out are you actually going to be able to get that door open. So you literally will have to wait until the car fills up at least halfway and maybe more with water until you have a chance of opening the door and swimming up to safety. It'll certainly take a lot of composure, but it is, if it's deep water, it gets even worse, because a front-loaded car, a car with an engine in the front is likely to flip over, and you're going to end up on the roof at the bottom if you can't get the door open sooner. So, remain calm and do what you can.
This is amazing. David, you really know your stuff. You were a literature major, I think, weren't you, at Penn?
No, it was history and English, yes.
Okay, same difference.
Same thing.
But yeah.
Same useful skills.
But
yes.
You know your physics. That's great. Yes, sir. Another question from the audience.
I was wondering if you were inspired by, influenced by, or responsible for, that I have found quite amusing at home, the board game, the worst case scenarios. Is that your product also, or could you comment on it?
We've done a number of games with University Games, who created that board game back. I think it came out around 2000, a year or two after the first book, and we've done a number of games with them, and it's been a success as well. Basically a trivia game that kind of lets you pick the right answer and see whether you emerge alive at the end of the game, basically.
Well, it's true, David, that you have more than a board game. You have note cards, I think. You have stationery. You have other things that people can give as gifts.
But
this is not commercial now.
No. This is all about saving people's lives. We do. We've been very lucky to have a number of different spin-offs. There have not yet been any action figures of me. So that license is still available. It actually remains a very, very vital brand, and I think still has a lot of legs.
Yes, sir.
Hi. The website advertising that your talk tonight talks about the tube that goes under the bay, and should your car become derailed under the bay...
Now, there's a tunnel under the bay, is that what you mean?
Right. Should I think come... so. I thought it mentioned that.
Yeah. Oh, the BART tube.
The BART tube that goes the subway under the bay.
Right.
That ends up in Oakland. Should your car become derailed, what do you do? How do we save ourselves?
Well, I haven't seen Bart's tracks under the bay, but we did. We have looked at what the safest thing to do is if you find yourself, you know, falling off the platform or having to make some sort of an escape in the subway tracks. And there is, in fact, a third rail that you'll want to avoid. If it goes in both directions, though, you may actually be able to get over to the other side. Especially if there's an oncoming train, that's going to be, you know, one of the places that will provide you with a little safety. Certainly, there are a number of electrical and maintenance rooms in subway stations and both near stations and throughout the tracks that provide some safe haven. If you notice, at least in New York, between tracks, there's often an alcove or pillars that separate, and these are again good safe havens for you to seek.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Out of the 13 books that you wrote, what is the most unlikely and absurd scenario?
The most unlikely and absurd one. They're all so likely. Boy, that's a good one. I guess it would probably be how to stop a runaway camel, maybe? Is that... It's just not something we encounter a lot here, but...
Fair enough. And so the other side of the question is, what's the most unlikely solution to, like, let's say, a plebeian scenario? Like, so out of whack and so out of box.
Well, I actually find the answer to how to take a punch to be completely out of whack, but then when you think about it, it makes sense. But when we first researched it, it sounded completely counterintuitive. The best course of action, if you can't completely dodge the punch, obviously, is to move towards it. In most cases, and an uppercut is different. That you just need to get out of the way of. But any other punch coming for your head, at your abdomen, you want to tighten your stomach, clench your jaw, and literally move towards the guy because it cuts off the force of the blow. And you know, I think unless you're a boxer, that's going to be completely counterintuitive and makes no sense. I will also add that I've always been extremely sad that we've never been able to get a bomb squad technician to tell us whether you cut the red or the yellow or the green wire. apparently there's no actual answer to that, despite what the movies would have you believe. So,
yes, sir, please.
Yes, this might be a bit insular, Dave, but given that your life is so consumed with the book business, have you thought about worst case scenario book publishing? And if so, what might be some of the inclusions?
I think about it every day. No, I think it's all mostly mundane stuff that you would encounter in the business world, you know, excess returns or, you know, what to do if you get to a signing and nobody shows up. These are things that I've definitely had to deal with. But it's a good BEA giveaway, I think.
Before we take the next questioner, David, I was fortunate recently to receive at home a copy of a fairly new a book that you've put out. It's a pop-up book, and it's about Graceland, and it's literally a walk through the life of Elvis Presley in Graceland. How did that come about? That's certainly different than what you've done typically.
Yeah. Well, Quirk Books is the publishing company that I run, and they're at quirkbooks.com, actually, now that I think of it. But we publish irreverent pop culture and pop reference books, sort of, you know, similar in vibe to the Worst Case Scenario series, but with a little bit more of a pop cultural feel, a little bit more, believe it or not, irreverence. And this past holiday, we published Graceland, an interactive pop-up, which is a $40 coffee table pop-up tour of Elvis's estate. And it just had always been a lifelong dream, I guess, to publish a pop-up book of Elvis's estate. It's actually true. But it's really, it was a great book to work on. We worked directly with his Priscilla wrote the foreword, and they took us on a great behind-the-scenes tour, and we just thought that the pop-up format was perfect for that because it's kind of kitschy, and it dimensionalizes the home in a way that actually makes sense.
It's an all-time coffee table book, the best I've ever seen. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, David. I have a question that probably some of the listeners would be very concerned about. If you were in one of the Twin Towers during 9/11, would you have jumped or would you have gone down the stairs?
Oh, boy. Yeah, you know, there isn't a right answer to that one, I think. We got a lot of calls, as you might imagine, after 9/11 about that sort of advice, or about advice from terror, you know, what to do if a terrorist takes over your plane, and people who wanted to talk about that kind of stuff and get us on CNN. And it would have been a good opportunity to, give some good information and also, you know, get a nice plug for the books, I guess. But we kind of made a very conscious decision to not go there. And you know, to this day, when a Boy Scout gets lost in the woods, someone still calls us up and says, hey, you know, what do you do if you're lost in the woods? And we still kind of resist talking about that stuff, just because we do see ourselves as providing real information, but publishing ultimately books that are meant for humor and entertainment. And you know, if they happen to save people's lives in a slightly tongue-in-cheek way, that's great. But we don't want to try to capitalize on people's tragedies. So. Yeah, I can't tell you what I would have done.
David, to what extent do you do scientific research, or people that work for Quirk Books do scientific research so that, number one, you feel comfortable in the accuracy of what you are publishing, and then there is the legal aspect. I know you made a little bit of a joke about it, but one always has to be concerned in this litigious society of ours.
Sure.
About that. So to what extent is this done and documented so that you feel you've got a good basis to make your recommendations?
Well, we go for every scenario that that involves that kind of information, whether it's specific technical or medical information, we always go to multiple primary sources for it. You know, it's never just one source. We're going to multiple experts for answers. We also obviously do some degree of testing. We certainly don't place ourselves in harm's way, but you know, if we're giving people instructions for how to tell direction with your watch, how to, you know, to use your watch as a compass, or how to build a fire without matches, or things that we can test, we always run those, you know, as many times as we can, and sometimes correct the instructions accordingly. But we certainly don't, you know, drive a car off into the river, or do anything particularly dangerous. We just rely on our experts for their knowledge. We have, however, been able to get some pretty notable experts, and in every book you'll see a list of all the sources at the back, the people that we've spoken with, and a lot of them are successful published authors and scientists and people of some real notoriety in their fields. So we're always pretty comfortable that we get good information.
Have you ever been sued?
I have, but not for these books.
Okay, won't go there then.
Is that an answer?
That's a great answer. Yes, ma'am.
David, I have an interesting question. Speaking of, 9/11 is history. Let's go forward to the 411 calls. What is the most interesting 411 emergency call scenario that you've ever encountered, and how to obstruct a solution, or how to come to a solution for that complication? Do you have any interesting, other than having a cat on the roof, or Do you have anything interesting in your book that mentions of an emergency call that has encountered with the readers, viewers, interest that is the most unique, most interesting?
Well, the books do contain a lot of quite useful medical information, actually, and most of it is quite extreme, you know, how to treat a severed limb or a bullet wound, stuff that you're not likely to encounter. But I did always find it interesting that when it comes to a bullet or a knife wound, all the doctors say, do not remove the bullet or the knife. You know, that's going to cause you to bleed to death much faster than if you attempt to remove it, or than if you leave it there, rather. And that is completely against what you see in the movies. You know, as soon as Arnie gets stabbed, I shouldn't. Am I going to get? He's now the governor. I probably just threatened him, right? But as soon as any action hero gets stabbed, they immediately remove the arrow or the knife and go on with the fight. And that's exactly what you shouldn't do unless you're, you know, years away or miles away from help.
Yes, sir.
What to do if the big waves break over your head when you are close to the shore? Anyway, you know, you just getting in or getting out, and the big waves come along and catches you and breaks
in the undertow. Well, you want to try to swim through. You know, anticipate the waves. Obviously, we have looked a little bit at that, and you want to launch yourself into them before they break. If you do find yourself pulled under, you really kind of have to take the ride, and so hopefully you've just taken a deep breath. The riptide is another thing that you might encounter, though, at the shore, and that's that you deal with a little differently. Again, you just kind of go with the flow there rather than try to struggle against it. Riptide, for those who may not know, is basically a current that will pull you out from the shore out to the open ocean. Often, you know, hundreds of yards, and the mistake people make is that they try to swim against the current, and you know, often run into problems or need to be saved or drown as a result of that struggle. And if you let yourself be taken out and then swim parallel to the shore, that's your best chance of escaping. So there are some answers to that.
David, your website talks about Quirk packaging, and it says that Quirk packaging controls access and rights to a slew of other high concept properties, including in this very political year upcoming and next year as well, how to be president. Now, does that mean that you could write a book with that title and give ideas to be president?
We did, actually, and Chronicle Books coincidentally published that one too. But it is—it's very much a manual for the incoming president. It's written as if it's the, you know, president's employee manual, and it tells you all sorts of, you know, very real procedures. You know, how to sign a bill and how to order pizza. You know, all the things you're going to want to know as the commander in chief.
Is that something that some of us in the audience ought to make a special note of?
How to
be commander-in-chief. Everything we need to know.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. I feel like you're my press agent all of a sudden. This is, thank you.
David, what has happened with Josh Pivens? Is he still part of the organization?
Well, he's always been the co-author on the books, you know, up until the more recent ones that have kind of taken a different turn. But the latest books we've started to do our worst case scenario almanacs, and so they do have some of the how-to skills, but they're actually more like reference books than anything else. The one that we just released on history has you know, some how-tos in there that could be relevant should you find yourself in a joust or dealing with the Black Plague. But most of the book is actually lists and charts of you know, profiles of horrible leaders in history, and 10 torture methods used in medieval times, and you know, it requires a sort of different acumen. So we've gone to a number of different authors to really pull together that research. They're a lot longer, these books, and they take a lot more effort.
Well, since I mentioned that I've known you since birth and know all the members of your family, but your brother, Joe, we used to call him Joey because that's what people call me all the time. Your brother, Joey, joined your company several years ago, both as an author and an executive producer. What is his job, and is he still participating in Quirk Books?
Yeah, he oversees the effort to license our books to other mediums, basically other media, film and television in particular. And his background is in film, as you know, and he's working on a couple of things that that may start to be get aired this year. He's got a movie based on one of our books that's optioned at Paramount, and there's a series at Discovery that he's working on that's actually quite relevant to what we're talking about tonight. It's called Extreme Encounters. And it's about what it feels like to be in some of these worst case situations. It's you know, what it actually feels like to drown or to be attacked by a shark or to be struck by lightning. It kind of takes you through the physical sensations of it and really brings it home in a different way. So you know, not only do we save you, we help you feel what it's like to go too. So it's we're kind of a full service book publishing company.
Well, I feel that this has been a terrific evening, and my worst-case scenario right now is that I must close the program. So let's give a big hand to the author of The Worst-Case Scenario, Survival Handbooks.
Thank you.
David Borgenicht is visiting us from Philadelphia, which is the home of Quirk Books, the company that he founded. And I want to thank David for all of your wonderful thoughts and presentation tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, is adjourned. Thank you.